Press 1 for English.
Welcome to the episode 14 of the Miri podcast. I'm your host, Tariq Al-Miri. This episode is in English, except for the next bit. لو تبي برنامج كويس تسمع بالعربي، ما تخافش وما تخافيش. عندي لك برنامج حلو، وخاصة لو كنت مهتم بالموسيقى العربية. أنا نشجعك لاستماع بودكاست دومتك من إنتاج صوت اللي في موسم الأول ركزوا على 10 فنانات عربيات وأغانيهم اللي كانت جزء من حياتنا وفي نفس الوقت سببت لهم مشاكل في حياتهم. والموسم الثاني لدومتك من إنتاج صوت حيغطي موضوع دخول أنواع جديدة من الموسيقى على المنطقة زي الروك والهيب هوب والإلكترونيك. اسمعوا بودكاست دومتك على كل تطبيقات البودكاست، وحتلاقوا الرابط في وصف هالحلقة. Great. I have two announcements for you. First, I'm super excited about this episode. Second, yesterday I've turned 37. I'm a few steps closer to 40, and I've been enjoying the journey of improving my mind, body, and self-awareness. I really hope that you're enjoying your own journey. Now, this week's guest is Hiba Layas, a designer, an architect, a mother, someone who's creative and resourceful in every field she gets into. And she gets into a lot of things, sometimes all at once. She's also a rebel, a caring, loving, outdoorsy human being. Hiba has got a lovely journey to share and a message that might make life easier for people who are now walking a similar journey to hers. In this Hidriza chat, we'll talk about her childhood and adventures in Liberia, the forced hijab's damaging effect, why Libya isn't her heaven, coping with living a double life, why she's conscious about her parenting role, finding her voice and interests and helping others, understanding the world through music, finally, her self-awareness. Warning, there are descriptions in this episode of violent scenes that could be shocking. If you're listening around children, please wear headphones. And if you're sensitive to these types of descriptions, please skip those scenes. Let's do it. How are you?
Tamam. Very well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. Nah, this is rubbish.
You're not allowed to edit, by the way. It's a conversation. I decide what goes in later.
Okay, go. Yeah. All right, go on then. Let's start from the beginning.
Don't edit.
Maybe let's change later. That. How are you? Because that, you know, that question, the last time someone asked that to me, I actually cried.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's the weather? Let's say, keep it British. Does that work?
No. No, just say, yeah, let's say, how are you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me. Very excited about recording this.
Yeah.
Little bit. Fire away.
A little bit excited and a little bit what?
Nervous, obviously, because I don't know which way this is going to go. And
it's going downhill from now. No, there's no way. We're not going up.
I'm just judging from your previous guests. You know, this is in a way, can be a bit, you know, therapy. And let's see how it goes.
Just to clarify, I'm not in any way, shape or form certified or qualified to do any therapy. But if you feel that it is, then no, that's something that makes me happy.
Yeah, no, it's just because we, you know, well, personally, I never get this opportunity to sit down in front of, you know, someone like yourself and, you know, talk about things that touch me or interest me, or, you know, I think it's I'm very flattered to be here.
I'm flattered that you took time off your day and made it, and you're ready to share whatever it is that we have mutually, or whatever it is that could teach me about who you are, your world, and how you see the world. And that's hopefully beneficial to other people who are listening. So it's a mutual let's say gratitude. I'd say, should we do the easy step?
Let's listen to some music.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
I got the good speaker next to you, so you're gonna experience it. You don't even need headphones. All right.
Surprise me.
Yo, I hope so. We're both going to be surprised because I have no references from you.
So is it just, is it on a shuffle mode or?
No. It's not. It's not that disorganized. There's a method to this ridiculousness that you see.
All right.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Very lovely.
Yeah.
Now you're gonna ask me who composed this, and then I'm gonna say absolutely no idea.
You know, the reason I chose it, actually, I never give thought the reason, but I think it has this symphonic orchestra. There's this planning and elements and ingredients that you as an architect or someone that is in that world does, not with these instruments, not with music, not with notes, but with other elements. So that's why I'm thinking this cross between the worlds. But regardless of that little bit of information, like I wasn't looking at you, but if you had closed your eyes, like, where would that take you as a place, as a mental space?
I think the first thing that came through my mind when I was listening to it was like an ice skating rink or something. I don't know, it just felt very sort of, there's motion to it. So it was not, you know, because sometimes you listen to pieces and they're very static, you know, in their rhythm. But I thought there was a lot of motion in that. Very peaceful, very nice. And it kind of transformed into something a bit more orientally at the end, doesn't it? I thought there was some oriental influences. It's very good. It was very nice. Yeah.
No memories, no travel.
Not particularly. No, I think my head is a bit too clouded for that kind of the spacing out bit.
All right. We might have to take you somewhere else. Bad in. There's another one. You're not coming off too easily.
No, but it was a good choice. Well done, Miri.
Yeah. Introduce yourself. Who is Hiba?
Hiba. I mean, it's a very tricky one, this question, because there's two Hibas, I think. There's two Hibas.
One is not enough.
No, in me, I always felt like that there was always another Hiba. You know, I don't like to believe that I'm the only one who lives some sort of a double life thing, or I can be Heber character one and I can be Heber character two, and the transition between them really depends on you know, who's around me, who am I talking to. I'm not saying that I'm two-faced, and, you know, but I think it comes out of respect and out of, you know, it's very diplomatic, I think, when someone can snap into between two modes, you know.
Is that still happening now, like at your growth?
Of course it will. I think it will always happen, even though, you know, close people, the closest people to me will, they will know there's another side of me, and I'm sure they do, you know, but it's just never been spoken about, and which is comfortable, you know, so to a certain extent to some people.
But if we dig deeper, can you give a label to HIBA 1 and another label to HIBA 2 and introduce both? So we know exactly what you're talking about. Because I can tell roughly what you're talking about, but people could be lost and thinking like, well, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, you know? Of course. Yeah, yeah. No, so, I can see how that can go.
So spell it out.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to keep it very simple. I think HIBA 1 is the real one, to be honest with you, where you'll see me at my truest and purest when I'm around friends. Because even simple things like jokes and a banter and things like that, you know, I can only kind of be myself when I'm around people who are like-minded, you know. And then obviously we have HIBA 2, who is the, you know, the one that everyone has to, you know, the one that, especially from where we come from and our background, you know, you have to kind of fill in certain, tick certain boxes to be, you know, that respectable person. Because you're, at the end of the day, you're carrying, you know, it's not just HIBA, I'm carrying my surname with it as well. And you know, touches a lot of other people. And I've always had an issue with that, you know, because it has always made me somehow restricted, you know, but it is what it is. And, you know, some, you know, you just kind of learn how to live with it.
Can I be yeah. annoying?
Yeah, go on.
I'm looking for details. So let's say I called HIBA 1 to go have coffee or do an activity that HIBA 1 likes and I mutually like. Fill in the gaps. What would we be doing and what would we be talking about and how would we enjoy our time? Yeah. Let's stick for a moment with HIBA 1. And what is she into? Like, give her a light, you know, the titles and work and...
I mean, HIBA 1, I think it's just so funny calling myself HIBA 1 and HIBA 2 is just so. I'm going to call Hebsky.
Okay.
Yeah, and HIBA, right?
Yeah,
right. So Hebsky is, you know, she's fun. I think since the word go, you know, the get go, if it's not fun, I'm not in, you know, from school days and, you know, So I think that's what kind of, you know, I orbit around fun things, you know, and don't take life too seriously. And the reason why I don't is because I think I've got good examples of people taking life too seriously and they become, you know, they get a bit miserable, you know. So the type of things that we would do, I mean, I really love music and festivals and, you know, just completely like zoning out for like 3-4 days and doing things that I like, you know, like the summer period when there's lots of festivals around, you know, that's where I love to be most of the time. I love going on really random, spontaneous holidays. So nothing, you know, very touristic-y, you know. What else? Music, always, you know, my life kind of revolves around that, you know. I don't like follow big names or big trends, you know. I always, you know, try to search for new things, you know. Like just the other day on Sunday, I bought a CD for, you know, just these two lovers. I think they were just recording, you know, their new album, and I absolutely fell in love with them. And it was about...
So she's an explorer. She's one that lives in the moment and just follows the muse and the interest and the excitement.
Exactly. And then you've got HIBA, who is a mother and a you know, my family. I'm the eldest in the family, so you know, I should be like the perfect role model. for my siblings and when we were growing up. But you know, there's that Heba, which I just kind of need to tune her down a little bit, you know, to fit in the Libyan world, say to speak, you know. So
the burden of being a certain someone, where does it come from? Like, according to how you feel it and see it, is it coming directly from immediate circle of family? Is it the pressure of society on the family, therefore it's delivered to you? Or is it you directly sensing it from the social circuit, al-mujtama, yani? Like, where do you experience that pressure?
It's definitely not a direct thing, you know. It's, you know, your second and third point, it's a little bit of those. I think we can trace this back to, you know, the late 80s and early 90s when when reality started to hit me a little bit, you know, because at that point, before that, we lived in Liberia for 7 years or so. And it was kind of my first experience.
Were you born in Liberia?
No, I was born in Tripoli.
Okay. And then how many years?
We moved there, I think when I was 2.5, maybe, or 3.
Okay.
Maybe 3. But yeah, so coming back to Libya when I was 11 or 12, 10, 11, I think it was, I think that was sort of like I was living in a bubble. And then when I came to Libya, it was...
Since we got their attention now, like, where does this come from? Can we talk about Liberia in a bit of detail? Because that's a phase that you didn't just brush off. Like, you grew up initially, like, there. How is life there? What do you remember? What are the things that you did?
I mean, it was a very, you know, very wonderful part of my childhood. I think it was the best, to be honest with you, because naturally I'm a very playful person, you know. I love, you know, playing. I mean, I remember most of my childhood was just climbing and running and roaming and, you know, and I love that about living in Liberia, because it gave me the opportunity to do that. You know, I think if I was brought up in Libya at that age, I'd be very restricted as to, you know, who I can play with and what I can play with and what I can do. And it really kind of, you know, created the first sort of stepping stones of, you know, how my personality developed since then.
Do you think that's really crucial? No, knowing that you have a son, Seni, who's 8 now, do you think this phase, like 0 to 5, 0 to 8, really, like, sticks with you?
Absolutely, absolutely, 100%. I mean, I can still remember, like, really, really, you know, very distant memories, you know, but how they made me feel is, you know, I still remember feelings, you know, and how pure and innocent and in the contrary, like, you know, flipping it back to Libya, I felt that was all robbed from me, you know, because it was very brutal the way how, you know,
the transition.
Yeah, it was just one summer, you know, forget about that life and into this world kind of thing. And I was hit by, you know, you're a girl and girls don't do this, and you're a boy. My brother would still carry on doing what we love doing the most, you know, like playing and getting on our bikes and on our skateboards and, you know, things like that, which we, you know, which I still kind of had, you know, did in the garden. Like we had a garden, we still did that, but it's not the same, you know, it was never the same.
What's the most precious thing that you actually used to love doing in Liberia?
Swimming, like in lakes and in really sort of dangerous territory, to be honest with you. I think my parents were a bit crazy to kind of take us to.
Are we talking crocodiles?
Yeah, we've been, we have.
You say that so casually, and I'm like, I'm putting my
so
parents.
So casual, honestly,
it,
they'll just say, do not go near that
crocodile.
Like, you wouldn't say crocodile, but that's where they kind of. Not nest, but, you know, what's the word when they kind of sunbathe? Yeah, exactly. So don't go around that area because, you know, you might
lose a leg.
You might, depending on how hungry they are.
Is that written, knowing that you're in graphic and design, is that written in a way that tells you how dangerous that is? Or is it just casual font, very, like, slim, like, Small text.
Small text. I think because of that, I think the fear of death, you know, never kind of bothered me, to be honest. And I think it's because, you know, we used to
hang around alligators. I'm still stuck there. Like, I cannot process this shit.
You know, we'd go in canoes, like little boat, really wobbly boats, and my dad would put all the stuff from Dad's Zarda in it, and it would be like carrying us and the Zarda stuff, and we could literally see the humps of the, you know, crocodiles and stuff, and but it wouldn't really faze us unless we kind of tipped over, you know, and then that's when you have to think about Plan B. But
I'm scared listening to this, to be honest.
But really, I think, like, my mom was terrified. My mom is a very, you know, she's very scared of these kind of things. But
I want to close this chapter, but just to think about it, like, what's the exit plan? Like, if one comes sniffing or like whatever they do near the boat.
I don't know. We never discussed that. I don't think. I think that's something left to our own.
Was your dad gonna sacrifice one? Is like, here's one.
Yeah, I've got four of these.
I think I need an episode with your dad about the lakes and the boat and the alligators, nothing else.
Also barracudas and ocean fishing and, you know, all sorts. We got up to, you know, lots of adventures.
So you had that, which is like, it's a fantasy. You don't even need to read stories about or rhyme, nursery rhymes about crocodiles or boats. Like, you are in that story. And then 12 years, yeah. Tripoli, Libya.
Tripoli, yeah.
What happens next? What's day one? Like, it sounds like you are someone that has a very vivid, detailed memories of a few days. Like, what's day one, week one, year one, whatever you remember?
It was very, I mean, the thing, it was not just coming to Libya. It was coming to Libya and our family being split up, you know. Mum had to go with my youngest, with Jude, my sister Jude and my brother to Benghazi. And I had to stay with my older brother and my dad in Tripoli because my dad was, you know, building our house back then in the mid 80s. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, out of the blue, I was living with my grandparents and there was a full house. I mean, they had like my auntie. There were like three or four families living in that, you know, house. And I remember one of my uncles just got married and they lived temporarily. It wasn't, I just came to...
Full house.
Full house and...
Busy adult.
Busy adults. And not only that, I think it was... and then I started feeling, right... This is my life, you know. Mm-hmm. How am I going to deal with it? And I started seeing, you know, the whole segregation thing, you know, boys and girls. And I started missing out, starting feeling jealous because my brother, you know, my uncles would take him out here and there, you know. And then he'd come back and tell me all, you know, all the stories and what he's been up to and all sorts. And I'm like, oh my God, this can't be my life. This is... I can't, you know, is this for real?
Is this the first moment that you felt that, oh, I am a girl?
Yeah.
And that is a problem. That is something different. Like, you never felt that ever before. Like,
never.
Like, there's nothing about being a girl that was an obstacle in your world before that point.
Exactly. And I think that's when it first hit me, you know.
But there was no talk, like, from any adult to say, by the way, like at arrival to say like things are different here. You have to experience it through the way things work, not necessarily through someone telling you.
No, it was just reality, and it hit and it just hits you in the face, and you deal with it on a daily basis. And you know, as a kid, you know, I would be miserable, I think. And I was really, really miserable. Those years was all about homework and
gedaya
and, you know, very programmed. And I mean, they were doing it for, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's the right thing to do.
That's the right thing to do, yeah. But yeah. I mean, to me, it was just too much to take, you know. Especially not having, you know, my mum around, and my dad was like constantly out looking after the building works and stuff. So I really didn't have anyone to bounce off, you know. But, you know, it continued for a couple of years and then what happened?
I remember you sharing, because I do my homework, obviously.
Yeah.
You shared quite a bit of really interesting things. I remember مدرسة ميتيقة للبنات. How was that like؟ يعني لما نسمع ميتيقة نفكر في حاجات عسكرية، like it's هي نفسها هذه اللي في جزيرة سوقتلات and around about.
You know when في الإذاعة؟
Yeah.
Okay. إذاعة تاع طرابلس.
Yeah.
Yeah, so okay. It's like on the it's like on a al corner hiki mtaha, you know.
Okay, معنا مش ميتيقة اللي الكبيرة. Okay, so it's not a militarized school, it's just a girl school. خلاص.
It's a girl school, ثانوية كانت.
Yeah. Do you wear uniforms?
Yeah, yeah, we were wearing like
green military
green stuff, yeah. No, actually, or was I wearing grey stuff? I can't remember, to be honest with you. I did wear green stuff
okay.
at one point, but I don't know if it was
when you say green stuff, you mean the camouflage. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Actually, I think I was wearing grey stuff now I think about it. I think it was the grey gilet.
How is that from a, let's say, an educational experience comparison? In that, Liberia, where you had to go to school, like 0 to 12?
Yeah, we went to British school. British so, school. Okay. Yeah.
That's another layer as well.
That's another layer. And it was...
How's that transition of
like... Oh, gosh. I mean, can you imagine my first day at school where I got introduced to العصا والضرب وال... طوب والفلقة وال
هذا كله ما فيش قبل يعني
absolutely no I mean it was
this is a fantasy of, this of a nightmare disaster like if you had to tell any of your friends from previous school they'll think you're like inventing a novel basically.
exactly and I grew very stubborn with all of this you know with all of this violence you know I was my brand was to you can't hit me on both hands you know الأبلات يحبوا يضربوك على خبطة هنا, you know?
Diversify the pain.
Yeah, so I would tell them to just like continue on my left hand. If you want to give me like, you know, 10 خبطة, 12 خبطة, just do it. And they would hate it, you know? They would be like, oh, she's actually got something to say.
Oh, so she thinks, that's a form of resistance.
Yeah, right? She's like, oh, so... and I remember she'd be like hitting me on my leg... to on my right side of my leg so I can take out my right hand and I would refuse until
بالعصا تضرب
بالعصا yeah على رجلي so that come on give me your other hand you know I'll be like hell no absolutely you're not getting that
so you're tolerating the pain just to make a point
yeah
it's worse feeling يعني ما هيش yeah. لأنه ما هيش تضرب تك هي تضرب بغل يعني.
بغل بصباح توبو whatever it is you know because I didn't do a homework or whatever the reason that even if you're late they'll hit you like في صباح ربي you know but yeah so I mean they didn't like any sort of you know resilient you know anyone who's kind of resisting in any way shape or form whether it be verbal or even you know
وانت من بدايتها resisting ولا انت زي ما تقولي you're basically revolting against a lot of things and this is the way to show it was it deliberate or was it just gradual you're like you know what I don't care
I think it was deliberate I always find myself slowly but surely really losing interest in school. You know, I started sitting in the back seats and, you know, making sure that my family knew that I was getting appalling grades, you know.
Just another form of revolting.
Yeah, like, absolutely. It was just saying that this is not on. And to the point where, you know, kids back in the day would be terrified to tell their parents that they got a جيد or a مقبول or, you know, had to be a ممتاز, had to be, because I had cousins and they were constantly like,
overachievers.
You know, الأول, جاب الأول. You know, what have you got to say? Kaka. what do you want?
In a way, you're aiming towards that. It's not like you're trying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my mission was, I go out, for me, it was a holiday club. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, okay, I've got the bag, I've got the books in it. Books have never been flipped. You know, we're talking ثانوي level now. This is at the point where I should be really focusing on...
High school, you're about to go to uni, yeah, basically.
I'm about to go to uni, but I still obviously had so many underlying issues, you know. But yeah, for Matsamaitiga, now that you mention it, my biggest, the one that they kicked me out of the school because of it, because I was trying to fight for a bunch of girls for their freedom. We used to have a teacher, a chemistry teacher, who used to take our break time So it was, you know, she'd have the Hassa Raba and then she would take the istiraha with it. So the istiraha was like another 45 minutes or something. So she would take that just because she's got so much knowledge that she loves to share with us.
Without asking you, without telling you.
It's just she felt like it, you know.
Okay.
Or maybe she was behind in her, I don't know, maybe she took a few days off Iris bint Khalita and now she has to make up for it. I don't know. I don't know what the insides are.
She's ambitious, but you guys pay the cost, basically.
Exactly, you know. So I mean, it happened, you know, a couple of times where, you know, give us our break time, you know. So
you can drop whatever.
So anyway, so we had obviously our friends on the other side of the door knocking, telling her, let them out. And she'd have the door shut. So one day, I've had enough of it. You know, I walked out in front of her, grabbed hold of the door.
The door itself.
The door, yeah. Itali, no, I have to be Ben Talian, you know, massive. We're not talking about like a standard, you know, B&Q door.
Razin,
yeah, but okay. It was knackered, you know. So anyway.
How do you manage to take it apart?
I think the thing is, it was hinges, you know, it's very sort of, you put this into that and it kind of goes in and out, you know.
Yeah,
so,
it's not screwed in actually, yeah.
You just lift it up and it kind of lands into the... You're
very casual about this. I think the fury is getting the
weight out. I just want it out, you know, because for us, it was very important to just go out, you know, get some fresh air. And
so
stuff
you
like
got
that.
Off your seat.
Got off my seat, walked in front of her. She didn't have a clue. She didn't have a clue what I was doing. Opened the door, kind of wiggled it a little bit until it came off the hooks.
So it's just opening the door and leaving is not enough.
No, because I wanted to make a statement, I think.
It's a big, bold statement. Okay, so you just
So I took it. Yeah, I grabbed it. I took the door, came off and walked straight across to the window and I chucked it in the courtyard, which is a quiet courtyard. It's not the main sort of istiraha area. It's like at the back.
I think this is not a statement. This is declaring war.
And it made a massive bang because you can imagine it was like a manwar, you know, like a manwar type of thing. And
So it's all walls,
yeah,
are
I think
like
it was
secure.
Like, it had three walls.
So the
thing
sound
around.
Is shooting up all the way.
Yeah, it just sounded like a bomb. I was just, you know, hit.
This is the aim. That's the goal, right?
Yeah, I wanted to make a big bang, you know. I was like...
But like, just describe the walk. Were you like wobbling with it? Was it long
I don't actually remember the actual walk itself, but I remember how it made me feel because I think I kind of nudged it out of my way a little bit, you know, like get out of my way kind of thing, you know, with that.
So in a way, the statement is like, you're lucky it's not you, it's the door. Because if you lift the door, you could probably lift her and...
I know.
So within this situation, what are the girls doing? Like, what did they? What are the sounds? What's the noise in the room?
Absolute silent. I mean, they were so quiet. The girls from the outside, they were kind of like they couldn't believe what they're just seeing, and. After that, I don't know what happened, but there was a bit of noise and she took me to, I'll tell you what happened. The girls that I tried to free, I told them actually, I said, right, everyone go out now, it's your break time, you know, and they didn't move an inch out of their seats, you
so
know,
passive.
They were like, as if nothing has just happened. And I looked like a total idiot, you know, because I kind of did that, you know, if I wanted to do it just for me, I think I'd have just walked out and let her waffle, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think there was a part of me thinking, look, I've done this for you girls. And, you know, I felt very disheartened about it. So I was the only one who got into trouble, straight into l'idara, as they may call it. Rufani l'stad Salem Khan, I think it was. And... Yeah, and then he said, well, yeah, I've got nothing to tell you. It's just malafik, or when we jibuk, tawa, mkalma, or mshafshino, blah, blah, blah.
That's the end of the line. You're
That's
out.
The end of the line. I'm out. Yeah, I'm out of the school.
Which year is this?
Ula Thanawi, but yeah, Ula Thanawi.
That's ballsy. It's not like it's akhir semester.
Yeah, girls get married at that age. You know, yeah. They start like, you know.
Like for you, like you still got two more years. like I would be careless if it not careless. I'll be very relaxed to do this. Mm-hmm. Not that I had the courage as you did. If it was like the finals week, yeah. There's exams. I'm not really going to see your face again, teacher. Yeah.
I think that's why they kicked me out, because they just saw like, you know, here comes trouble. Let's get it out of the way. You know,
there's two more years of this.
Two more years of this. Exactly.
Okay. So the result, the outcome is not what you expected.
No, it wasn't. But I think it made me feel satisfied for a long time. You know, the fact that not only that I managed to nka'ak the whole sahifa, which was ace, you know. Oh, I didn't get to the point why I was rebelling against this school. And throughout my teenage years, I was forced to go, you know, to wear hijab.
Mm. As part of the uniform.
No, it was just a family. I don't know what happened to Libya between the years.
So it just to clarify, it wasn't a requirement in the school?
No.
It wasn't. So there are girls like all over.
Yeah, no, there were girls who didn't wear it. No, absolutely not.
You didn't wear it in Liberia. Family didn't care, immediate family, I'm assuming. Or it wasn't something that was interesting or of interest. Amtabdit, when did this hijab element got introduced to you as an idea or forced? I don't know if it was.
I mean, it wasn't. Well, how it happened was sort of in the early 90s, let's say, a movement of some sort. I don't know from which direction, but the influence was on Shabab Libya, you know, like my uncles and friends, brothers, and, you know, it kind of أثرت في طبقة معينة. And they started infiltrating the homes, you know. And I think that's how it kicked off. It started off being, you know.
And you say the early 90s because this is when you experienced it? Or is it actually historically accurate and that there is a...
This is when I experienced it, because everything before that, prior to that, was very cool, you know, like...
And we're talking specifically 93, 94, or early 90s.
I can't remember, to be honest with you. I remember when I started... I had to wear it when I was in Ula Thanawi.
Ula Thanawi, okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking 16, 17.
Mm. And the option was like, you know, there's no need for you to go to school if you don't put it on, you know?
Mm.
Yeah. And I think our...
What's the clarification
to you? The consequences or what?
No, like what? Why is it as... Not as. Why is it even more important than your education in terms of how it was presented to you?
I don't know. It's just the way. I think if they've, you know, it was, you know, the whole targhib thing. I think they started, like, when I say they, it was family, okay? Not immediate family, but surroundings, you know, like uncles and things like that. Extended family. They... You know, for بداية بدو بالترغيب والترهيب and little books here and there and what will happen to you if, you know, if you don't put the hijab on, في جحيم تقدي معلقم من شعرك, and they painted all these like images. And for me, because like I said to you, I don't fear death, really. I do not fear death. I mean, I think I mentioned to you before that I'm a biker, you know, I ride motorbikes every day that I get on it. I know there's like a 90% chance that I'm going to die, you know, and it doesn't stop my day. It doesn't, you know. So I've always had that trait in my personality, I think, from, you know, when I was very young. And
so the way they presented it to you, it didn't press the right buttons that was intended.
Exactly. You know, so what you're saying that if I don't do this, I'm going to die, and I'm going to die a very bad death. But I don't fear it. So what are you trying to get to?
Yeah, what's the goal here?
What's the goal here? I mean, I wasn't able to communicate it back then. And I felt I was in a position of just accept it, because this is what they expect of you, you know, it's just to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was the core problem, that they didn't realize that you were telling me that this will happen to you, but it harkatch fi ashara famat, you know, they're saying... Anyway, I mean, I could go very deep in this topic, but
so basically, it's just not... you took it on, not accepting. You're just like, all right, but you had a huge butt with that.
Mm-hmm.
Like the reason you were so rebellious at the school.
Oh yeah, because I was forced to, you know, it was Ula Thanawi. I was, before that I was in the school with my brother, my cousin, our neighbors. It was a mixed school. I absolutely loved it because they were the only people that, you know, I had in my life at the point, you know, and to take that away from me, and take me to a school that is God knows how many miles away, and which is probably for the best. It was the best school in Libya, and I'm in Trablus, and I'm sure my,
does,
you know,
that
my
mean, took you away. Is it a boarding school?
No, not boarding school.
Oh, okay, like many miles away, just because it's too far from the house.
You mean? Yeah, it's too far. I mean, we lived in Janzoura, and this was like the Fost al Blad, you know. And I'm sure they had all good intentions, you know, because this is where it was the kind of best thing around. I didn't obviously see all of that, you know. I just saw, like I said, you know, if it's not fun, it's not for me, you know. And that's my sort of motto in life.
It's very interesting that that's defined early on, and you still that person. You still live by that, and you still
always
enjoy that.
Always, always. I've
so you've cracked sort of your system of operation, your view of the world, very early on in life. But it's so freaking frustrating because
it's just now that I'm talking about it.
Yeah, because the location completely conflicts with that mode of operation. You being you, being a girl, so that like you're in the middle of a conflict because of your DNA. Essentially, a lot of your DNA, which is like,
yeah, which and is questionable,
gender / DNA. You know, I'm just trying to like drift with this idea a bit more. On the back of the heads for people listening, thinking, you know, like I'm in the wrong place now. That could change, but you don't necessarily have to change. You can hide it, you can tweak it, you can play with it until the right moment arises.
Absolutely.
Essentially, but before digging into that. Education, school, you really, is it over? Like high school, did you end it with a bang?
Did I end it with a bang?
The floor. Or like what happens to you education-wise?
Education-wise, I managed to flog it. Okay. I don't know how.
Did you go back to that school or did you go to your parents, by the way, had al malaf?
Had al malaf, here's the kakat and everything. In the end, they did take me back to the school that I actually wanted to go to.
Oh, okay.
So the following year after they saw, so my, you know, I rebelled and I got my kind of way, but okay. A year late. So lahaqt ba'din ala khuya wa wald ammi fost al fasl, they were like, you know.
Okay. Oh, so you went to a mixed school by then?
Yeah, by then I went to a mixed school because they said, right, if this is what's going to be happening,
let's contain that.
You know.
Okay. So that was
so
a
better
school for you.
It was better for me because I had people that, you know, I had my friends. I had, you know, my brother was there. I was still very tight with my brother back then and my cousin, and we got up to all sorts, you know. We learned how to drive together. We used to, you know, take the car and the gala and go around and, you know, so I have, you know, those were like the fun, you know, years of my life in Libya, even though it was very, you know, restricted, but I kind of managed to have a little bit of fun. So I was in Thania Thanawi and I was very much in touch with what's happening outside, the world outside. You know, Ken Fetat Hisar, I don't know if you remember.
Which year?
97.
97, yeah. 2003 actually is when it ended. So in the middle of it, basically.
Middle of it, yeah, exactly. But my dad used to travel a lot, you know.
Hisar embargo, yeah, basically, for people that are not familiar with the term. There's so many lovely themes we live through. حصار والثورة والحرب والجماهيرية والهالبحاجات يعني فال 97 that day, which summertime.
But prior to that, I mean, you know, when I was ثالث عدادي ثاني عدادي أولى ثانوي, you know, I was very interested in what's happening outside في ليبيا, and my only sort of source of it was when my dad travels and he comes back, and I'd always ask him to get me, you know, CDs, just CDs. I just want a CD. Of whatever, just you pick it. So for a long time, I was my dad influenced my musical taste, you know.
Oh wow!
Without even him knowing, he was probably just looking at the charts and thinking, right, that's number one. I'm going to get it.
That's trending. What is it, HMV or
probably like something
Virgin
like
Mega
that
store.
Yeah, and then we had like and then we started getting, I don't know if you remember, the Viva channel.
Yes, that music, triangles. Music videos.
Yeah, like the triangles, like yellow and blue triangles, looks like an IKEA logo. But I was really sort of thinking, oh my God, there's a different world out there, and I'm really gagging to meet it. I want to meet this world, you know. I want to see it.
And you haven't traveled for that whole block since arriving.
Yeah, I think we went once to Morocco for like a summer holiday, and we went to Portugal. We went to Portugal actually one summer. So throughout that period, yeah, it's very limited, you know.
But still, that kind of creates this longing of like, I want to do what other people my age are doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to, I remember my dad got me like a stereo, like it was a Sony yellow player. It was amazing. And I used to, you know, even when I'm having a bath and a shower, I used to bring it with me in the toilet. And my mom would be like, no, this is jnoon, musiqa, jnoon and everything. But I still do it till today.
You know, oddly enough, like for the past couple of months, Jude links up with me through music, whether it's dancing or listening to something new. And I'm obsessed with it. It's my reset. So when I'm not having conversations, I'm editing or listening to podcasts, a lot of the time it gets to your head because it's a lot of ideas and talking. Your mind spins. So music in the shower is where it kind of resets. And for many years, I think, who is that one ridiculous person that would buy a waterproof Bluetooth speaker? And I've searched that yesterday. I'm going to get one. Because when you put the iPhone to the side and you're having a shower, it's not loud enough. Yeah. So I needed to come out of the
I bought one not too long ago. I've got it in the car, show it to you when we go downstairs. It's totally waterproof. Yeah, you can can float with you in the bath if you like.
Does it sound good?
Wonder absolutely
water
amazing,
full
yeah.
steam. All right.
Yeah, no, it's called Wonder Boom.
Don't be scared. I won't be posting videos of Instagram for this activity. Music was a part of your life, and it's through it.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually the only source, right? Like, it's not like you had YouTube videos or films.
Absolutely not.
Or,
no, I was just watching.
Because also at that like stage, although the system would have been comparable because there's VHS tapes, right? Like for movies or series or whatever. But there's the PAL system and all of that. I guess it's compatible with Europe. You could have had movies. Were you big on movies or just mostly music?
Back then, I think it was just music. I don't think we were, you know, I used to record a lot, you know, with my Garyunas. Do you remember
them?
Yeah. I used to record a lot of them and rewind and fast forward and write the lyrics down and try to get the spelling right, you know. So it was a project for me, you know, just to kind of understand what these guys are.
So who are your companions at that stage? Like, who are you actually listening to artist-wise?
Oh, back then? Oh, I can remember Ace of Base, you know.
Oof.
Do you remember?
Yeah.
Oh, that was good.
Heavy Flash from the past. Okay.
What else? There was the Fugees, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
Bit of Tupac, Biggie Smalls, you know, the sort of...
good taste.
Yeah.
I like the Fugees a lot, actually. It's been a while. So you had this idea of a world out there, and comes that summer...
Then comes that summer.
You're going to go there. Like, what are you thinking? You're like, oh.
Yeah, so my dad dropped the news. He's saying that we're going to go. I think I've got a job position for London. And
you're like, say no more. You just packed.
Was that like a mission? I was just like.
Yes. No, like, what were you feeling? Like, did you buy it?
I think with
I just can't imagine.
I you have to be very diplomatic in situations like this. You have to show that you're not very interested.
So the resistance is still on.
Yes.
Like the protest.
You can't sort of sell it on saying that, you know, thank goodness for that kind of thing, you know. So you have to play it cool. So I think I was playing it cool, if I remember correctly.
Mm.
Until...
You didn't play it cool for long, you know? Like for what, a couple of days in?
Yeah, I remember I had to send, you know, write letters to my friends in Libya at the time, you know. Yeah, and we had to write letters to each other, and I'm thinking in the back of my head, I'm getting the I love yous and everything, but you know, it's time for Hebsky to go. Anyway, so we went on the boat trip. Yeah. It sounds very sort of
romantic and cool. And
yeah, it wasn't a boat trip. It was like one of these ships that
It's like a massive ferry boats. Do they take cars as well? Are they these huge ones?
I can't remember. I don't think we had a car, but
The worst part of it, how people describe it, because there's a lot of people who get seasick and they're not used to it, so you're constantly sitting around people who are like actively
agitating.
Yeah, actively just, you know.
I don't remember I've seen any of this stuff. I remember we just got on the boat, on the ship, on the decking, and then as we were like leaving Tripoli.
What were you dressed as, like, to begin with, Diane?
I had to, dress as, like, how I usually dress, which is sarwal, suriya tuila, and mahrama, you know.
Hijab,
that's how I left. Yeah, that's how I left Trablus and...
Proper Hibba uniform, not Hebsky.
Hibba uniform back then, which is the only one I knew, to be honest with you, until that day.
Mm-hmm.
I got on, we got on the ship. It was kind of sunsetty, so it was nice day, and we were all like getting together to take this like family photo of Tripoli in the background, kind of slowly fading away, and I was just like, I don't know, something got to me and said, like, it was an opportunity for me to speak out. I just felt like I was off land, and there's something very powerful when you're outside of someone's territory that gives you this empowerment. I don't know, that's how I felt, and I think that's what kind of fueled me, you know. I'm like, I am off the land.
Yeah.
The land that for me, to many people, it's heaven, you know. To many people, this is Libya, Jannah. For me, it wasn't, given my circumstances and how I had to deal with things, you know. I just had this thing and I was just like, right, this is me. This is my opportunity. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I haven't planned it out, but it just kind of came. And I just took the mahrama off. I unwrapped it off my head.
Where were you? Like,
we were in the deck, we were outside,
people walking, family.
Yeah, people walking, and I just kind of took it off and I just chucked it down the sea. And it was, I think
like, you say that very lightly, so you just unpinned it.
Yeah.
Is there a pin?
Or? Probably, yeah, there's probably a pin. I wasn't
So you unpinned it, just took it aside. Is there anyone looking? Like, how close is...
I don't know. I think at that point, everyone was just... It was a moment where everyone's just waving bye to Libya, to Trablus. Do you know what I mean?
So like, you're still looking at Trablus. It's not
you're not halfway through. Maybe not at that particular moment where we're like just meters away. I mean, we could still see the skyline, you know, and...
But Tripoli's seeing you on the other side. That's big enough. You're looking at it and then unpinned that.
And... unwrapped it and I just threw it.
It's like massive throw.
Yeah, it was a chuck.
Chuck. Oh,
yeah,
wow.
I chucked it. I chucked it. It felt, how can I say this? I have no problem with, by the way, with anyone wearing the hijab, especially if you're doing it, from your own doing. You know, this is 100%. Convinced that that's what you should do, then absolutely go for it.
My mom,
my sister, and I respect them for that, and this is what they want to do. And but for me, because it was forced on me,
how did that moment feel?
It felt very freeing. It felt I was born again, you know. It really did feel that I was 17, you know, coming on to 18. I did feel maturity into making that decision, you know. If it took a lot of guts,
I could say that.
Yeah.
But it's all internal. It's all that
it was all internal
moment.
and to be honest with you, I think my mom and dad, they just witnessed it. They witnessed the moment and they didn't have much to say about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We just carried on as if that never occurred.
Mm-hmm.
Or it didn't happen. We didn't speak about it. I just continued living, you know. This is it. I kind of like announced, I think, in an indirect way that, you know, I've been putting up with a lot of with a lot of stuff, and and now it's my kind of time. I think for them it wasn't very how can I say this? It wasn't very comforting for them to witness, because maybe that was alarm bells, you know, saying, right, we're going to be struggling with this one.
It's a different chapter here.
It's a different chapter. But I always, you know, I always, I don't want to upset them, you know, but there's this thing about respect in Libya that we take it way too seriously. Because, you know, by respect, by you know, respecting your mom, your dad, your uncles, your family, your qabila, your name, your tribe, all of that, by respect, the only person that you're disrespecting is you. And
not only disrespecting, you're muting, you're erasing, you're just completely ignoring that person for something that is barely tangible, barely there, you know? You did that knowing that there might be a return, because your dad just had a job. It's not like a complete relocation for indefinite amount of time.
Usually it's like a 5 to 7 year thing maximum, you know?
So how
I wasn't thinking that. I've never thought like that far ahead, you know? Just take it each day as it comes, and
just enjoy that one experience and live as if this moment is the only thing you got.
So that was my exit of Tripoli at the age of 17.
It's like just dropping mics on the move, on the sea.
Yeah.
Complete water.
Yeah. And you move on.
Wait, did you stare at it as it goes away? Hijab,
I think I just went blank, you know. It was too, I don't know, it was such a powerful thing that I don't think I really focused too much.
Did you talk to
I think I was looking for facial expressions. I was looking for answers. I was looking for communication. I was looking for just not even appreciation, but just saying, like, even for my brothers and my sister, I don't think they've
acknowledged it.
They obviously did, but it wasn't, you know, I was begging for some sort of interaction, positive or negative. But, you know, that's what we do best, the Libyans. We are very good at brushing things under the carpet.
But for you, you wanted that moment to count, and you wanted something to, like, touch it, make it real. It hasn't happened.
No.
Did you talk to friends about it?
Oh, yeah, afterwards. Yeah, I did. I mean, you know, we did take that family photo, by the way, on the deck. And I've got it until today, and it was one with me with Hepsky and not
Oh, okay, nice.
So I just felt like, you know, I kind of,
so is that what triggered it? Like, there's a picture happening here of a big stage in the family, but I want to be me.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to be the other one.
Yeah. And I think because we were talking about this, let's take the picture, I think that's what
pushed your button.
Pushed my button, yeah. And it's just, you know, pictures. I've always had an issue with pictures anyway, you know. They kind of always say something.
At the same time, like, there's something I've somehow are aware of more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, being a guy, you can never picture yourself thinking, like, inside the house with your family. This is not criticism of this thing in particular, but, like, as a visual experience, as an identity thing, if hijab mafrut on the guys themselves and I have to wear it, it's a bit of a struggle in the sense that I am a certain way. I'm just like this in front of you with my family, my wife, my brother, sister, mother. I need to burden myself to wear something and look a certain way, not necessarily by choice. Even if it was by choice. But, like, let's say for the category of people, which is like you, which is, I assume it's a lot of people. What does that do to you? Because you didn't choose to look like this. You had to look like this. Not for a moment, not for a day, not for an hour, for a big chunk of time being outside the house. For like a few hours and sleeping, you're somewhere, or you, like, you look like a completely different being. Like, I don't know what does that do to someone's mind, you know, like
over a number of years, you mean?
Exactly. Like when you look at yourself in the mirror, in pictures, as you mentioned, interactions with others, and that having that layer forces you to behave and look and interact a certain way. I don't know, what does that do to your mind, you know, after exactly, as you said, number of
damage?
Years.
It does a lot of damage, you know. it builds up. And I think one of the forms that it ends up in is probably depression, and I was probably depressed at that age, you know, in my teenage years. I was,
and it's looked at very dismissively. It's okay, there's a lot of social pressures to behave and do certain things, but it's almost like we're just talking about a piece of cloth, but the reality is it's
imprisoning. You feel like, you know, they've walked all over your personal space, like you say, it's like you are forced to possess someone that's not you, you know. It's just, and carry
you have
that
to
weight.
Act like that person, which you do not identify with, and
exactly
do not want to be,
and that's, you know, mental torture that it can really bring you down. And if it didn't show in those years, but it's something that you will carry with you, and one of these days, you know, the bubble will burst, you know.
And oppositely, if we're in a split universe, there's an app actually on one of the podcasts I'm listening to about if there is always an option of like you doing one thing and someone else exactly like you doing the opposite. It's called splitting the universe. It's very weird. Anyways, oppositely, if we're in a different universe, you wanted to have the hijab, but you were forced to live somewhere where that's not allowed, and you identify so highly with it, that does the same damage, essentially. So we're not being both. Like, I'm assuming you're not, and I'm not being critical of people that want to, by choice, by understanding, by taking the steps to decide for themselves.
Absolutely. Like what's happening in France and Paris and, you know, Muslim girls who are not allowed to wear their hijab, you know?
Schools, public places.
I get your point.
Within that, is it a combination of like by nature and by habit? Meaning like early on, the early years, you're very close to your siblings, brothers, your dad loved these activities, therefore this is what you're introduced to. And then slowly but surely, you also saw the other side, got introduced to it, and you're like, meh, not for me. You went back. So it's a combination of both, or is it like one or the other? Like how do you read you, basically? And your interests?
I think girls, I've always realized that, you know, no matter what circle of girls I'm in, they're a bit complicated for my liking, you know? Let's not talk about the bitchiness and the... I just like the banter that happens when I'm with, you know, men company, boy company. I love the... it's just not serious at all. There's always fun. There's always, you know... I like that element of it. I don't like lemmat or jol sabaya or
albsiki lips tadika or makeup.
Yeah, or shifti mshafreshin labs or any. I just don't get that chat, you know. I don't get it. To me, it's
the
it can
social,
be very interesting.
The social activities of boys are interesting to you because you relate. You relate
exactly
to it.
Yeah.
That exchange is healthy for you, basically.
Definitely.
Although some of it is not, yeah, I can have my two cents on that. We're sort of in conflict of combination. Yeah. Not that I'm into makeup or anything, but I think the company of boys for the boys tends to be very testosterone competitive as well on other things. So I think a balance is also needed.
Absolutely. I mean, when I'm in a fidaira, I mean, you know, of boys, I think they always kind of have this, not sympathetic look, but, you know, she's a girl, you know, let's be easy on her. Let's be this on her. Let's be, do you see what I mean? But I suppose I didn't really mind it that much as long as I wasn't like in a boring sort of surrounding, you know.
Can we summarize that phase? So London, I'm assuming high school, uni, and then discovering what you want to do with your life, work-wise, interest, speciality. How could you... It's not an easy question, but like if we like squeeze that phase, take us there. You arrived to London. What happens next?
Well, London to me was gosh, I mean, coming here at 17, it was an eye opener. There's so many things that I had to learn, and I had to learn it quick, and I didn't want to miss out on things because of my lack of knowledge. And so I was very sort of, I was trying to pick up what I've missed, you know. But then I've also had, you know, my family, and they were very limiting at the beginning, you know, limiting my exposure, you know, to the real world. And I think that's due to, obviously, you know, what they know and how they've been advised. You know, we have other members of family who brought up kids here, and they're very strict, and they're very much guiding my family and how to, you know, this is how you do it. If you want to bring up, you know,
good kids
in a Western corrupted society, then you better follow our footsteps. And I think that was very damaging, to be honest. They didn't give my parents a chance to...
So right off the bat, them arriving here, they had social pressure on them.
Yeah.
So essentially they they got away from the land, but they couldn't get away from the ideas.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous saying, isn't there? They say you can take the Libyan out of Libya, but you can't take Libya out of the Libyan, you know?
But here we are. We're discussing... Libya and the Libyans and the ideas, but on a human level, I think we get sucked in, and a lot of people always listening and interacting with this, thinking that we're only fixating on Libyans. We're talking about our human experience, what we went through. You happen to be Libyan, I happen to be Libyan, but I'm sure, like, if you take these stickers and labels away to a neighboring country, an African country, an Eastern country, even somewhere off the beaten track in Texas could potentially live these scenarios if you remove the stickers and labels.
Yes.
So that's why it's interesting on a human level, but we have to dig deep so people relate on a Libya level as well. But again, like, yeah, as you said, you can't really get rid of the idea. So your parents had to interact with that sphere of existing Libyans here.
Exactly. Exactly. But having said that, I was always pushing for, you know, discovery. I just wanted to discover more. I wanted to learn more. I mean, they could be like really pathetic things that I wanted to find out about more. But
not to pick on you, but just something to observe, like, even with all of that pressure, the family wasn't highly pressuring that they've beaten this curiosity out of you, or their rebelliousness, or the interest to be who you are. Like, it hasn't been taken out from you. Like, it was always there, or is that like your own protection maintained it? Like,
I think my own protection maintained it. And the fact that, you know, the older I got, the more acceptance. I mean, I'm talking the older I got, we're talking about 28, 29, you know, very old to be able to start accepting. So you can imagine that the all those years were, you know, it wasn't a smooth ride. I mean,
they've accepted who you are when you reach that 28, 29 years. Yeah, okay.
And when I say accepted who I am, I mean, I'm nothing outrageously, you know, I just wanted to be me, and I didn't want to.
I mean, for starters, you're wearing wings, so I mean, I think you're pushing it a bit. You're not as normal as you think
it's
you
chicken
are.
Chicken wing, you know, there's a difference between a chicken wing and a and a canary.
I don't want to dig deep on the wing classification, but you're not as normal as you think you are. No judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, I think you're exceptional.
Well,
yeah.
I think,
in a few ways, many ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I suppose I am. You know, all I really want out of all of this, you know, waffling, if you want to call it, is I just don't want it to repeat again to you know, with my son. I'm trying very hard. You can't take that away from it, but I just don't want it to rule him. You know, I don't want all of these sort of social barriers to.
Mm-hmm. You want the good side, the aspects of the cultures, the history, that side of identity to be enforcing, empowering him.
Exactly.
And how he sees it as well.
Yeah, but not the struggle side of it, you know. I don't want him to experience that ever. It's very sort of, it's really damaging, and the damage is...
But it's much easier on the boys, no? Or is that an assumption?
I don't know. I think when it comes to speaking your mind, it doesn't matter if you're a boy or a girl, you know.
There is no acceptance of another idea or something different. By the way, you notice we haven't done the classical introduction of who you are, what you do. Are you
interested in it?
No?
I've done it. Didn't I do it? I said, I'm Heba.
Yeah, yeah. But like in terms of... Really? That's all we've done a lot. Like in terms of the classical, you're like, I'm an architect working on this.
Oh, forget about that. Like, forget about that side of me. Because to me, what I'm doing now today is just, I can't call myself an architect. I can't call myself an engineer or a graphic designer or a mother. I think...
You are all of those as well.
All of those, yeah. You know, it's just, I'm tapping into, like, the thing is, I can't stay in one job for too long. You know, I always like to bounce off different projects, you know.
But then, interestingly enough, there is after you've done all those, and people are quite key, like part of the element of this is people understanding how they could be who you are in terms of what your career is. Now, it could be like this compilation of things. So how did that come about? Your interest in design, architecture, the projects you've done, working in Amsterdam, working back in Libya before revolution, after revolution, how did that come about? Yeah, I mean, like in the midst of struggle, will kakat and crap grades, which I relate to heavily,
yeah.
When you do something you're not interested in as a curriculum or blah blah blah, versus, oh, I found it. This is me. This is what I love doing. Whether I get paid or don't get paid, it doesn't matter. So how did that discovery of like passion around creating? Because I hate the labels as well. And I think you're much more versatile than, no disrespecting architects. Like I had an architect, Siraj, in episode 3. Really interesting, very inspiring. But it's to me, it feels like an anomaly when someone finds that thing and thinks, whew. I found it when I was fil adadi or whatever. Like, this is not real life. Like, real life is dabbling with things, and I think you've done that really well.
For me, when I was here, when I came at 17 with no tawjihi, you know, it was very hard for me to kind of join a university, you know, because I had to do like a year foundation course, and I don't know what it was called, but... I did all of that, and
the reason... English, you're still learning English still, right?
Yeah, then? I mean, my English was stopped at, you know, the age of 12, so whatever I...
Oh, so it's basically almost a complete restart from scratch.
Yeah, I mean, I had to learn new words and vocabulary and...
It's fascinating. You speak English very well. How did you learn that? Did you ever get that question?
Your Sorry, accent, you don't have an accent.
Yeah, how do you do that stuff? You know,
it's just listening to a lot of music, I think, and okay. You know,
it's those damn movies. Fugees.
Yeah, Fugees, and
so yeah, you had to figure it out.
Okay, so I went to University of Westminster. They had on the list computational mathematics. My parents, my mum and dad, they were like, "Oh, this is it, you know, go ahead, this is the future." You know, obviously, darf jayem in Libya dmaghi fadi, because I don't know how I scraped it, you know. I don't know how I managed to continue until 30th Thanawi, because there was, like, I was empty, you know. My brain was just, there's nothing, there's no ma'lumat in it, exactly.
Quite noisy.
So that's why I chose architecture. I was just like, right, this is the only course on the list that doesn't have exams, and it's all down to coursework.
Very strategic.
And okay. And I thought, right, well, when I did computational mathematics, I failed like the first semester, the first term, just, you know, fail. Then I told them, I didn't even tell my mom and dad, I just went straight and registered with the architectural thing. It was architectural engineering, and it was great. I was just acing it, you know, year after year, and I kind of found what I was looking for, you know. Did the whole thing. Did part one and part two, and worked with engineers for a couple of years. Well, not a couple of years, for nearly 10 years. And then moved back into, you know, the architectural project didn't really interest me too much. There was a lot of paperwork and politics and, you know, it was really boring for me, you know. So I wanted short projects.
You just wanted to do what you actually wanted to do, nothing in general.
Exactly. I just want to, you know, that's why I kind of like graphic design, you know. It was very sort of quick, fast, you know, bish, bash, bosh, next kind of thing. And obviously because I was a single mum, well, I still am, you know, I had to be very flexible with times and, you know, hours away from my son's school, et cetera, et cetera. So I had to be very available. And I really like, you know, the flexibility of it. Also tapping into a little bit of property investment and management with a great friend of mine that we knew for 15 years. I knew for 15 years. So we're doing a bit of that as well. Hustling, really. So that's why I don't like to label myself as one thing or the other. You know, I can bounce off a few things, I suppose. My dad works for the Smart Khariji at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know how it is, they've got a time, well, you got a couple of years and then, you know, time for the next one. So it was my dad's time to go back.
2011-12, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the time, you know, we just packed everything. I was married. There was so many issues, I don't even want to tap into that marriage. But
we might have to for just a little bit,
oh,
but
gosh.
Not now. We'll pin it down to something down the stage, because it's very interesting to me, the single mom aspect, which is you. It's a very, very interesting characteristic.
Yeah, it's a big part of me, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. So we need to get into it. But at the same time, summarize sort of you, architecture, design, very cool projects, Libya, that segment. Like, so basically, as you said, family as a whole went back because of father's work. Yeah. You now see yourself surrounded with Libya again. How does that make you feel? Were you prepared for it? Was it a different thing? Was it a different Hibba version coming back?
Yes, absolutely. It was
Or was it Hepsky coming back?
It was Hepsky, definitely Hepsky, but I still had the Hibba shield, you know.
Ah, okay. So it's like you have the two channels constantly in.
Yeah, but it was more Hibba back then, you know, because there was a lot of I have to adapt, you know. I had to adapt a lot, but it was fine. I mean, people,
even post revolution, like, you had to adapt.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I had to adapt. I think just from a respect, you know, kind of thing. I didn't want to be too loud, you know, and hurt people and create noise. And
what did you actually want to do? Like, what's this chaos that you're going to bring
about?
I
didn't. The thing is, I don't even have to say anything. I think sometimes it's just my you know, the aura that I bring into the room, or the attitude, you know, not even attitude. I want to say attitude, but, you know, I'd walk in.
Did you want to walk in dressed like this?
No, not necessarily. But, you know.
Which is not an issue, to be honest. But, like, is this the loudness? Is this as loud as it gets? Is this the problem?
I think it can get a little bit louder, but. All right.
No, I get it. So the minds have not changed. The point I want to get to, the mind have not changed or upgraded with the revolution. There was no software update, and the gap that you're gone and came back, according to how you've seen it, nothing changed
apart from, you know, a couple of new fancy cafes here and there.
Okay.
You know, that was, but like inside there, you know, the mentality was very much the same still.
Okay. But how did you cope with that? What did you decide?
I think I just kind of chose to be in a bubble, you know. You know, I was still in my little bubble. I was a single mom, still trying to get over the mess with the marriage and you know, all of that stuff. At the same time, I felt it was a temporary fix, you know, because I think eventually I knew that I was going to go back to London, you know, when my son is old enough.
This is a transition phase, basically.
It was another transition phase. I mean, and it was down to me, like, in these years to do something about it, you know. So I got really busy with getting myself involved with all sorts, you know, building related projects and you know, got introduced to really interesting people.
So you started your own company there.
I did.
Didn't work for anybody.
No. I mean, I did at the beginning work with someone.
Okay.
Can I do fil Hanagar? I don't know. They say Hanagar fi Libya.
Yeah.
Sort of space frames, and they clad them up and make them into salat afrah or into the, you know, the bowling thing or.
So these are like big, massive spaces. The material is not super expensive, but they need to be creatively designed to fit purpose.
Yeah, so I designed a supermarket, Salat Afrah, the bowling
thing. And your experience of doing this before is like you've worked in Amsterdam, you worked in the UK, you've done a few buildings, you have a lot on
UCV. To be honest, my involvement with these Hanagar was not the structural element of it. It was just to make it look pretty.
Okay.
You know, so there's a lot of interior, stuff and the cladding and how to make it look less of a boring old warehouse, etc. So I did a couple of them, you know, over like 6 to 8 months.
And then there was one interesting project.
Yeah, that was... That was when I was working on my own. I started a company and I started sort of just experimenting, meeting people. And one of the most interesting ones that I've worked on was this guy who, very rich, you know, and he had like a crazy budget for istiraha. So he calls me up. He said, so-and-so, I've heard... this and this about you. Do you fancy coming over to just have a look at my project? So I went in. To my surprise, it was like massive land.
Okay.
And he said, I want a little istiraha here, but a massive underground, a massive like underground scene, you know?
So the idea is to have a very tiny, let's say, a weekend little house on the top.
Mm-hmm. Like a guest house.
Just like you'd have just like his neighbors, but underground.
Underground, he wanted a nightclub.
Okay, oh wow.
Yeah, so not only nightclub, I think it was more of a gentleman's club because he had in mind that he was going to invite like, people, his friends, his buddies, and for a good, good weekend in Tripoli, you know? So that was the brief and he hit me with it, out of the blue. And it was just like, this is what I want.
You were never expecting that this kind of idea will happen from a client him in Libya.
Absolutely. I didn't think. I mean, he was kind of some Mufi Sheikh, not Sheikh as in Sheikh, but it's a respectable thing, like Khalo Sheikh or whatever. I didn't expect it from him, to be honest with you. And even when he was saying it to me that that's what he wanted, he felt like, can I even ask this, kind of thing.
But he's Sheikh overground, but underground. he's a party guy, basically.
So, I mean, that was an interesting project because I got, for me, a project is a project. I don't care if it's an underground one or above ground, I just like the early stages of a project where you kind of get to kind of collect ideas and try to see which direction it's going to move on to. So
what happens next?
I just instantly thought, right, underground bunkers, Italian era, طليان كانوا يبنوا في شنو يقولوا لهم هم
ريفوجيو.
Not refugio, but they looked like bunkers, they looked like turtles,
I remember storage houses above ground that looked like that. Yeah, okay.
So I that was my inspiration for the design, and it wasn't built because it kind of things went a bit crazy.
Which year was this?
I believe it was maybe 2013, 14.
So that's the
because I left in 2015. So it was between 2012 and 15, and I think 2013 I was probably be 2014.
You've delivered what he requested, essentially, but you have no idea if it took place or didn't.
Yes, no, I don't.
Is this part of the agreement to keep it a secret in this?
Yeah, I think I'll never reveal where it is.
Oh.
And if just in case it did go ahead.
Yeah.
But I have some really lovely drawings to show for it. Yeah.
for future bunker / underground clubs in Libya for new clients.
It's interesting what you know, what happens behind closed doors, you know, even in a...
But it kind of also speaks to the duality of, like, you know, I think you call it respect of, like, there are certain things you do outside to the public, to the bigger circle, and there's things that you keep to yourself. Therefore, we have Hiba 1, Hiba 2. Yeah. That's why we have a stiraha and a club. But yeah, it's crazy, no?
Yeah.
Like, it just...
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it's resourceful, it's creative. And you're the right person to fix that problem.
Gosh, yes, pressure.
We're in Libya, and you're working on these projects. I think at the same time, you discovered something, and it's something about young Libyans, youth. Mm-hmm. You've opened space for them, you collaborated. Like, how? What's that like?
I think it started when it took me a couple of months to kind of settle into the whole Libyan thing. And then I managed to work with a guy who does these hanaga, like I mentioned earlier. I've just noticed that his, you know, he was like in his 20s, and all of his friends were really sort of gagging for... just, you know, something new, something fresh, you know, and I think I was kind of there for that, you know, and they were really sort of, oh, how do you do this and how do you do that? And I've, you know, I came in with some tools, you know, like the 3D modeling and, you know, some certain software. And I just love to share these kind of things with them, especially if you find, you know, a bunch of people who are interested. It's nothing more pleasurable than sharing it with them, you know, so... that's where the idea of let me start, you know, have like a little sort of open workshop studio space that, you know, invite people around for talks or for just sharing ideas. And so that's what I did.
So you set up a place?
Yeah, I set up a place, and it was in our house. There was like a 3 meter width of unused space, 3 meter by 17.
On top of land or underground?
No, just on the garden, because you're supposed to have 3 meters before the Surum Tajarak. So it was between our house and Sur Jarna.
I was trying to crack a joke about underground, but it just...
Oh, it flew my mind.
Didn't land at all.
No, not that underground, no. Huh?
So you had the space, people knew about it, or you had to invite people over?
No, just, you know, it took a couple of months to build, like 4 months. And as soon as I started off, you know, I already had sort of a little network around me, and you know, the word just kind of... people just, you know, they start inviting their friends, and we'd enter competitions. I had like university students just doing their final sort of portfolio, coming in, you know, whenever they can, just to share ideas, you know, get some sort of kind of like criticizing their work and in the hope for, you know, something
positively positive. Criticizing.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, it has to be a positive thing. So that was great fun, you know. Libya Build was kicking off. It was, I think, it's their most successful year.
Is that the big construction exhibition?
Yeah. Where we hired out a stand and exhibited some of our works, and you know, we got a bit more known through that. But the dream didn't continue for too long. It was only a couple of years, you know. It was from like I said, 2012 to 2015. Personally, I think I needed that. I needed that exposure, you know, for me to kind of have closure, you know, and sort of like it kind of wiped off the bad vibes and the bad memories I had of Libya, you know. And it was sadly, like I said, it didn't last for too long, because I had to make a move at that point. My son was coming to a school age, and I really needed to move on. But I still kept in touch with...
Why did you need to move on, and why?
Because, I, you know, I always wanted for Sunny to start school here in England. That was kind of my personal goal, you know.
Because that shaped your schooling as well, Liberia kind of thing, yeah, international
school.
Yeah, I think
it's really important, you know, the early years. The thing is, for me, I think because I've experienced it and it was, I think, the best part of my life, and I just didn't want to take it away from my son, you know, even, especially that I had the means to. Yeah, so that was 2015, so came back here, starting from scratch all over again. You know, new area, new neighborhood, trying to kind of blend in. Always kind of lived in London, and this time in 2015, bit, you know, it was like a more of a countryside scenario. It took some time to adjust to as well, you know, being far away from the hustle and bustle.
Just to give it a space and time, not because the big events matter so much, but like, so it was the right phase for you to relocate, but was there like a major event happening in Libya that you decided, you know what, it's not really going well for what I had in mind, or that was irrelevant?
That was irrelevant, I think, because I always knew it was a temporary, you know.
Yeah. For you, like, it's not a 100%
fitting.
Just deal with
it. It was just deal with it, you know. Yeah, there were highs and there were lows, but, you know, I don't recall any sort of scarring moments, you know?
Yeah. Because you're so busy doing the work that you love, and there's a community. There's a lot of Hepsky type activities and ideas, and you are kind of yourself in Libya.
In my bubble.
In your bubble. Like, we've been dabbling around the idea of, you know, single mom. We mentioned Sini, your son, a few times. It's a very interesting experience for me. I'm quite curious. But before all of that, there was a wedding and there is a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that stuck in my head, that the whole thing, as it started for you, you said it was an automated wedding or an automated marriage. Or was it automatic or automated? I don't remember, you know.
Well, it, you know, things happen, you know, sometimes without you having so much control in them, you know. All I had control of was my biological call, you know. I think I was ready to, you know, to kind of step up a level. And, you know, I was 30 at the time. I felt, you know, I've done this, I've done that and the other, and now it's kind of time for me to see what I'm like as a mum. I think I felt like I was ready for it. However, it just happened to be the guy that I you know, I got married to, because he was there at the right time. At, you know, I was working between Rotterdam and Libya on a project, Radames, to be specific.
Rotterdam in the Netherlands.
Netherlands, yes, Holland. There was a little project that kind of involved me going back and forth a couple of times, and that's where I met his sister, my ex's sister, and she was an architect, and, you know, it just kicked off from there, very innocently, you know. Oh, he's single, he's a good guy, you know. Are you into مرتبطة? قالت لي, قلت لها, no, I'm not مرتبطة. And then she said,
engaged,
right, yeah. And she said, well, you know, if you're interested, would like to get to know you and blah, blah, blah. So, I mean, that's how it all kicked off. So, you know, innocently, I went to my dad and I said, well, this happened. You know, do you want to do your private investigation kind of thing and see if he is actually a good guy? Everyone in Libya is a good guy. Every guy from Libya is a good guy.
I think when you say that, I conclude, like, on paper, they fit the right profile of a good guy for the marriage experience.
Exactly.
Alorag, yeah.
So, you know, he was as good as you can get.
For that year's batch, or like, what do you mean?
I don't know how it was. It was just, for me, it felt like, okay, this is going to make, again, everyone happy. you know.
This is another societal transaction.
Absolutely. You know, if left down to me, I don't think I would have gone through it, you know.
But like, initially you didn't initiate. You're like, I'm ready. This profile exists, but were there alarms that, you know, Hepsky has that the others don't?
On the first, you know, the first conversation I ever had with this guy was a very truthful one. You know, I did not hide a single detail of my past, you know.
Okay.
Very open as to what I expect from a marriage, very open as to, you know, and he came across as being a very open-minded guy, you know.
What were you expecting? Like, what were you wanting as a marriage?
I mean, don't forget, I was in my 30s, so I've already formed in my head what the perfect ideal marriage scenario is about. And it's about communication, really. And if you could have, I felt that I could have communicated with him on a level, and maybe he played me really well for at least a year, thinking that he is on my level. But
so safe to say, you were yourself. You were Hepsky.
Absolutely, 100%.
Because you knew you wanted to be yourself around this. You're there's no performance in that arena.
Yeah, no. I never hid for one day. I mean, that my hiding days are over, and I've was very, very honest with him as to what I expected from all of this. So anyway, so we got married.
So no alarms still, nothing.
Yeah, it kind of kicked off. I remember we were only like 3-4 months within the marriage, and then his true colors really started showing. And we were in London at that point, done all the paperwork, and it kind of hit me later that I think that's what he was all about, you know. But I was just so blind to see it at the time, you know.
What was he about?
Just, you know, having the opportunity to get out of Libya, you know, like on a spouse visa. I think that was the highlight of the marriage for him. Yeah. It's a very common thing, by the way. I mean, this stuff happens a lot, you know. And if there was one message that I want to take out of this little bit that I'm sharing, it's just for girls to be careful. You know, girls are in a similar situation. And for girls, you know, that's what they end up doing. You know, they end up marrying someone from Libya, most of them, you know. They will tell you that, they'll tell you sweet little things and, you know.
Because I think the main conflict with this is there is an assumption of compatibility because he is also Libyan, but there is no investigation on the compatibility of personality, what you want, and is it actually a true intention to have a relationship that is marriage based instead of like, all right, let's get on with the steps to get the paperwork done. Yeah. So there's two conflicts that play up. Because of what society thinks is compatibility versus the character or the experience or the expectation compatibility. What happened after paperwork? Or what was it like before and what was it like after?
Well, before it was just,
it sounds,
you know,
like it's very quick for me.
It was a very quick thing. I mean, you know, from when we first met each other to actual wedding bells, it only took about 8 to 10 months, I think. And most of that time I was in Holland and he was in Libya, and we were doing, like, you know, a lot of Skype calling or whatever it was back in the day. So it wasn't real, you know. Out of the blue, it was like, fadhania, you know, fadhania, dinna fadhania. But I was just kind of going with the flow, you know, just gambling in a way, you know. There's a bit of gambling in that. But like I say, you know, I was ready, you know, I was ready to kind of take that role, you know. Things didn't work out, you know. He just sort of, like, you know, was really disappointed, to be honest with you, in how serious he was about marriage, about responsibility, about, you know, all sorts. He actually left us, and that was in 2012. Yeah, and I've been a single mom since then, and... It's a very interesting journey, I must say.
So it wasn't like a build-up to a divorce, was it, out of the blue?
It wasn't, no, it wasn't a divorce. It was basically, we came back to Libya in 2012, I think I've mentioned to you. Back then, you know, we were all meant to go back to Libya together, me, him, my son, mum, dad. We had a container, we shipped all of our stuff. And on the day, he just said that I'm going to catch up with you guys, you know, next week or whatever. I've just got a few things to do here with my sister. And we said, right, fine. So, yeah, and that was that day. That was, you know, he's never explained as to why he didn't show up or why he didn't fight for us. Because as far as I was concerned, there was no underlying issues. We just all had to move back to Libya, you know. So that was that. I just found myself dealing with, like, you know, when reality started kicking in. A week gone by, a month, a year, 2 years, you know, no word of this. I was still kind of in touch with this family. I'd do what is expected of me to do. You know, I'd take Sani to see his grandmother, his cousins, his other side of the family. And I was doing that on a weekly basis.
In Libya,
yeah, when I was there. But there was nothing from him, you know, there was absolutely...
And all of that is like, you have no actual information from any sources to tell you this is happening or that's happening. It's just ambiguous.
Yeah, I mean, there were like some, you know, headlines here and there, nothing directly from him, you know.
You have no information, no sources, direct and indirect, to tell you that this is it, it's over, whatever. There's no like a classical, sorry, done, this is not working out.
No, there wasn't any of that stuff.
Strange, like, so it's completely...
It was very open, very much open for years, you know, for years it was very open. I didn't know where I stood in this, you know, relationship.
So it's really upon you to decide what to do next, right? It could go so many ways.
Exactly. I just chose to be busy, you know. I had the luxury of having my mum and dad around. So, you know, they helped me immensely with Sani. Which gave me the opportunity to do what I did, you know, and at that time. But the realization of becoming a single mum had begun to hit me, you know. You know, every week, every day, every, you know, and slowly you find yourself sort of transitioning, you know, your role. Because, you know, obviously Sani was very young at the time. He didn't know what was going on, but I felt that...
How old was he, like, in this...
A year?
A year. Oh, that's it.
Yeah, a year and a month or something like that. No.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I just took it, you know. And started dealing with it. Did really well for when I was in Fi Trablus, you know. I did manage to make some money. And when I came here, you know, Sani obviously is a bit older now and questions asked. You know, it is what it is. We've moved on with our lives, you know. We've kind of... worked around the fact that you know, we don't have a man in our lives, which is fine, you know, people do. I'm not the first or the last one, you know. But it made me kind of question my role a little bit as a mum, because, you know, luckily I am quite an outdoorsy mum, you know. I did all the things that a dad, I think, would do. You know, the whole bike thing, learning, teaching him how to ride a bike, and you know, swimming, you know, a lot of things. I mean, one of the things that I felt that was really missing in Sani's life is to go and have a haircut, you know, like go to the barbers. And that's what inspired my my look.
I mentioned, I don't have a reference of how you used to look, so this is how you look to me, but I'm assuming
before.
There were decisions made to get to this look.
There was no decisions made. It was just a mad moment where...
And by look, we mean short hair.
Yeah.
So
the short hair. I mean, it all started off one day, one evening. It was just Sunny and I. And I just felt that, you know, I want to do this thing with him. You know, I want, let's go to the barbers and let's go watch football. Time it when Chelsea's playing with whatever, you know, and let's go and hear all the banter and sit down and get all excited about it and hear the jokes. And yeah, so that's how it all kicked off. So one night I just told Sunny, get the clippers and can you do the back? So I started from the front. He's like, what the heck are you doing? And I was like, don't worry about it. Just, you know, sort out the back for me.
How old is he then?
He was probably about six. No, five. It was when he started reception. So what was reception? He was four and a half.
Yeah, just actually where my daughter Jude is right now, actually. Yeah.
So it was our first. So even people in the new community that I live in now, they don't know me as Heba with long hair. They all know me like, you know, that's how I kind of chose to introduce myself to this new world. But yeah, so it was a mad moment. We did it. And since then we go to the barbers together and we do this sort of mummy and son thing, you know?
So what's he like if you had to describe Sunny?
Sunny?
Yeah.
Sunny, he's at eight now, right? Very cheeky chappy. Yeah, he's a cheeky chappy. He can be very lazy, but I'm trying to fight that off him, you know? No, he's a nice guy. He's good. You know, I think he's had a good childhood so far. And him having not having a dad in his life, I think he has managed to work around that. But only him can tell me. So I will wait to hear from Sunny in a couple of years' time.
There's a segment of rebelling in Libya that we missed. We're trying to link up to this kind of personality trait as that kind of links up with cutting the hair as well. I think there was a motorcycle phase and there was a Wrangler phase that are in Libya. Like, how did you think it was okay to buy a motorcycle and ride it in Libya at that moment?
I didn't buy it. I shipped it with everything that I owned when I was in London.
Ah, okay. So you had it here already?
I had it here, and as I was shipping...
What kind of motorcycle was it?
It was a Suzuki Madeira. It was a baby engine, 125. But yeah, I think I've always had a craze about toys, you know, powerful toys. I loved not necessarily the speed and everything. It was just the freedom, the ability to not feel scared. I think that, you know, that's why I loved riding bikes. You know, it, like I said to you earlier, I think I mentioned that I don't fear death. I think I fear, obviously, being in an accident and losing a limb or trying to live the rest of my life with that. I think that's what I feared most, but death itself I didn't. And I think being having that experience, I mean, I've rode bikes for about 10 years plus, you know, found it very hard to go back to a car when I had Sunny. I was riding a motorbike until I was 8 months pregnant, until I got, you know, the keys got confiscated from me. So I felt like a real naughty bad mom, you know. In Libya, how did that come about? So when we went back to Libya, it was in the back of the, you know, in the container. It kind of generated a lot of interest, you know, a lot of kids loved it.
Picking on the single mom aspect of how your day goes, and I'm very obsessed with the 60 minutes because to me that's sort of how the rest of the day could be shaped. So when you wake up weekdays, generally, what do you do in the first 60 minutes to make sure that your day flows the way you want it? What's your secret?
It all depends on how good of a night I've had the night before, sleep-wise. If all goes to plan and I'm up bright and early, I think I'm a very early bird type of girl. You know, I wake up early. I make sure that I've got that hour before Sunny wakes up because it's very vital, you know? You know, I don't meditate or anything like that, but just having some quiet time just to draw up on my to-do list and see, you know, what tasks I've got ahead of me with a cup of coffee, some music in the background. I think that's a good way to start the day. you know. And then when Sunny wakes up, it's it all kicks off, you know. I don't have any secrets, to be honest with you. It's just go with the flow.
Looking forward 10 years from now, how's life with projects, with work, with Sunny? And also, is there many other things to rebel against?
Oh, gosh. Of course, there will always be many things to rebel against. I think I am entering a new phase, you know, being 40. I turned 40 in April, and life begins at 40. I believe, you know, I am experiencing it right now. I feel I've put all of those bad vibes and bad experiences and just, you know, kind of chucked them the back, and looking forward to my new adventures. Mainly, I think my first goal really is to be a bit more independent, you know, rely less on my family for starters, you know, because, you know, being a mutallaqa and all of that stuff, being a single mom, you know, you get a bit of sympathy, you know, and a bit of help and this and that. I just feel like be totally independent, you know, get my own place and set Sunny up for something good, you know.
We reach a very interesting point, and I remember, I think this is part of the reason why you're here, is that you do have a message to the girls, right?
Message to the girls. The main one really is not to forget about yourself and your well-being, your happiness over, you know, making others happy, you know, because that's a very temporary happiness that they will live for a very short-lived time. They might boast about it and it's great, but I think the aftermath of that little sort of high of happiness that they get is really damaging, you know, if you don't wake up. I think the other message for single mums, you know, Libyan single mums who, before they become single, a lot of them are still trapped, you know, in really sort of horrible situations, you know, and they just have to accept it, you know. I have a handful of stories that I know, and I just feel like, you know, if you're not happy, just get out of it, you know. Get, life is too short to be dealing with, like, you know, little trivial things. And a lot of mums will say, oh, but I won't be able to survive on my own, and they put all these kind of like barriers, and so they just keep doing what they're doing. And but I just feel like if you're not happy, just move on quickly, swiftly. Things will always work out, you know.
Things will open up when you decide.
Exactly. Just, you know, make sure that you're well educated and you know where you're kind of going.
Aside from this message, why did you say yes to this? To the interview, yes.
Why did I say
Tedriza,
yes? I mean, up until today, didn't I text you this morning and say, like, Miri, I have no idea why I'm doing this, you know? But I think it's becoming a bit more apparent to me now, and it's the opportunity to the listeners to share with them my experience in the hope that, you know, some of it is relatable, you know. And, you know, in terms of depth, I don't think I've kind of touched on like deep things at all. It was just a general Tedriza. But I just want to tell these little girls out there, you know, that life will always, you know, make room for you, for your adventures, and, you know, you're just going to have to take it in your stride and be the best you can be, and don't take any BS from anyone and just be yourself. You don't have to be crazy or wild, you know, but
they can break a few doors.
Exactly. Just standard. Rip them out. Chuck them. Chuck them out the window.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to have you and to chat with you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to your lovely studio.
This is it for this week. I'm Tarek, your host. Would you like a weekly email sent to your inbox? An email that includes a link to the new episode, tips from guests, direct links with what was discussed in the episode, you know, like music, products, and books. Yes? Okay. Then you can go to tarekilmiri.com.
TARIQELMERI.com and hit the subscribe button on the top right corner and enter your email. Stay tuned for next week. You'll be listening to...
My favorite kind of podcasts are not the ones where I agree with everything and I know the story and I love the person I'm listening to and all of their views are the same as mine.
This is it. See you next week.